Continuing with Walsh on 13th August 76.
Well, at this time I'd left your room, and after I finally finished the thesis and so forth, I gradually drifted away somewhat. Although I still maintained contact with it, I had those friends here and so on, and lived not too far away, so I was aware of a bit of what was going on. Soon after I left and went to Francis, I was invited by Professor Lovell to come back on some fellowship. For various reasons, I wasn't able to. And then in 1959, September, I left Francis, went to the States, went to the University of Michigan to work on a space radio astronomy project there with Fred Haddock.
I see. And what was the nature of this project?
So I was trying to measure low frequency cosmic noise from above the ionosphere. I mean, the ionosphere sets a cutoff at 10 megahertz, mm-hmm. and way below that, maybe Reber managed to go down to 2 megahertz and less in the Tasmanian. But we felt that it would be good to get up above the ionosphere and see what really happened. You got down to a megahertz and more. So I was involved in the design and construction of a payload to measure cosmic noise at frequency down to 0.75 megahertz. Put a payload on a rocket which was launched in September 1962, and in fact we did make successful measurements of cosmic noise at 1.2 and 2 megahertz.
Launched from Cape Canaveral?
No, it was launched from Lordstown, Virginia.
Oh yes. So this was not a satellite? This was
it was not a satellite,
it was a rocket.
It was a rocket that went up to 1700 kilometers altitude.
I see, no, I haven't heard about this at all.
To get all above the peak of the atmosphere. Well, I can give you a reference to it.
Yes, please. So the reference for this experiment is the Space Research 4, Proceedings of the Fourth International Space Science Symposium at Warsaw, published in 64 by Walsh, Haddock, and Schulte, all from the University of Michigan. And what were the special difficulties that you had in designing this package?
We're going to be working with, well, first of all, the mechanical problems of erecting an antenna when you got down there. And the antenna was very short compared with the wavelength at 1 megahertz. The wavelength is 300 meters, 1,000 feet or thereabouts. We were working with an antenna that was 40 feet long.
Essentially an infinitesimal dipole.
That's right, yes. It was, and the impedance was highly reactive. Radiation resistance was very small. Capacity was of the order of 1 ohm. The capacity of reactance was of the order of a few thousand ohms. So you've got a very high quality, very high Q capacitor.
Right.
And a very low loss capacitor there in effect. And so there were problems of coupling this into the receiver. And one of the problems that was important was the impedance of this, the impedance behavior in the ionosphere. We'd be going, even when we got above the peak of the ionosphere, there would still be plasma around us, which would affect the impedance. So if we tried, for example, to build a highly tuned system, put a tuned capacity antenna against a reactive, inductive reactance, then as soon as we got any disturbance by the plasma around, it would go way off tune. So we couldn't work with a tuned system. And so we worked with a system that was not a match system. And we put a device on for measuring impedance of the antenna. So we had a calibration sequence, which we disconnect the antenna from the receiver and measure its impedance. And we also flew a solid-state noise source, a diode noise source, solid-state diode noise source, which generated a very high noise level, which was fairly stable, mm-hmm. to provide a gain reference for the receiver. And the technical difficulties were just in the... I don't think there were any major technical difficulties. It was once we understood the principle, once we decided the principles of the receiver, it was fairly straightforward.
Yeah.
But it flew very successfully, it operated beautifully. We got some unexpected results and bonuses that, in fact, I'm still involved with even now on the follow-up of some of that work. I still do some satellite work now. I have still analysing some results from the Area 4 satellite.
And I see.
Payload on that, which was launched. 1971.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said that
frequencies went as low as 0.75 megahertz.
Yes.
And did you get measurements at all these?
No, we didn't get a measurement at 0.75 megahertz. We did get them at 1.2 and 2.0 megahertz.
Mm-hmm.
And this showed, in fact, a fall off. As you come down in frequency, the ground-based measurements show that the sky brightness increases.
Right.
And then we found that between 2 megahertz and 1.2, it had fallen quite sharply by a factor of about 2. So we had evidence for a turnover in the background, which I think has been confirmed by a number of satellites and so forth since. But this was the first real observation of anything like this.
And you had virtually no angular...
No. It was a broad beam.
Right. And so you were just assuming that this was the galactic background?
More of this, yes.
There wasn't anything else you expected to be contributing?
Well, we had to be careful because, you see, on the way up, we got some very intense noise signals. And the records were very complex. The variations of receiver output as we went up and down were very complex. And it took a long time before I was able to interpret these sensibly. Among other things, you see, we didn't have a direct measurement of the local plasma frequency, which is vital to the interpretation of the records. But we were able to, sort of, bootstrap method, able to obtain a reasonable atmospheric profile, and we're able to show that you can see these intense noise levels that go up by a factor of more than 10 above the peak cosmic noise that we measure. This is cosmic noise here.
Right.
But when you've got disturbing signals like this, then...
This is as the rocket was on its way back down.
That's right, yeah. You wonder what it was. Well, in fact, we were able to show that it corresponded to... A bit complicated to explain in a few words, but certain combinations of local plasma frequency and gyro frequency. Namely, when the receiver frequency was between the local plasma frequency and the upper Heimlich frequency, and also above the local gyro frequency, then there's a region there, the so-called CMA diagram, where there's very intense local noise, and the plasma has got some rather remarkable characteristics in that region.
Well, I'll have to take a look at this paper, yes.
This was the first detection of this, an identification showing the classification of this, and it's been explored by quite a number of other groups since. For example, Stone's group at
Goddard
has done a number of experiments to observe this. The Alouette satellites, Alouette and ISIS series have done quite a number of measurements, and on Ariel 4 I've been doing some further exploration.
So this was the first radio astronomy above the ionosphere, essentially, however?
Well, there was an earlier measurement by our observation, and it wasn't a very accurate measurement, by the Canadian group, Chapman and Malozzi, on I've forgotten the name of the satellite, about 1916, was it? It was about 1960 or so that they, 1960-61, they did a measurement, but it was, I don't think it was a very reliable one, and it was at best only gave us an order of magnitude at 3.8 megahertz. But ours were much more accurately calibrated, and we were able to account for antenna impedance variations and so on.
One might say the first proper experiment.
I think so, yes.
So this occupied you at Michigan for a couple of years, I guess, or more than that.
Well, I was at Michigan for 8 years altogether. And,
oh, really?
This and follow-up with various satellites were what I was involved in.
Further satellite radio astronomy experiments? Or?
Oh, yeah. We had payloads on at Michigan. We had payloads on the first 5 OGO satellites to try and measure various things of radio astronomical interest.
I see. And where was most of this work published?
Well, a lot of it wasn't, because the work wasn't too successful. But there has been a little bit published. I wasn't involved in any publications with that. Haddock and Gradel and Hector Alvarez have published several papers over the years on some of the results from on solar bursts and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I wasn't really too involved with that person.
I'm just noting this Chapman references Nature, volume 191, page 480 in 1961, and also in Space Research 2, page 597, the proceedings of the conference. So, and then you apparently came back to Jodl, but this is now getting into the late 60s, which
is
beyond my
cutoff. Yeah, that was the end of 1967 when I came back to Jodl.
Okay. Well, in closing, is there any comments you'd like to make about the development of radio astronomy, especially at Jodl, as you've seen it in the late 50s? For instance, what do you think is the main strength that Jodl has had in terms of contributing to the development of radio astronomy?
Well, I think one of the features at Jodl distinguish it, for example, from Cambridge, is that it has been less specialised. It's been more the Model 1 in its miniature is a more general purpose thing. Lends itself to observations of many different characters, of spectral line work. One element of interferometry giving you a lot of sensitivity and primary resolution. And I think an outstanding example of this was when pulsars were discovered, Mark 1 was able to go straight in on that and do a very good job in a number of directions there. I think the versatility of Mark 1 has been a great feature.
You don't think that, it sounds like you don't think the Mark 1 essentially damaged the nature of the group here. I've heard other people say that...
Well, it changed it.
Whether
it damaged it, I don't know. That's, I mean, the emphasis went in the course of a few years from meteors and upper atmosphere work to what we now regard as mainstream radio astronomy.
Right.
I've been in radio astronomy in the beginning, but I was kind of in the minority when I first started here at Jodl. But there was no doubt about the direction in which things were going even then.
But it also did not change the philosophy, though, of how one does things. You couldn't be by yourself working on your own apparatus so much and running your own show. You had to schedule so much time on the dish, and you had to be much more of a totally organized thing.
Oh, yeah, things had to be more organized and systematized, yes. But I don't think it's... I think you could overemphasize that. I mean... Well, since I came back to Jodl, I pursued the direction I wanted pretty well with average interference.
Yeah.
Been able to have colleagues and research students working with me on these things. I don't think that I think we can overemphasize it.
Okay. Well, I think that's all I have, unless you have something else. All right, thank you very much.
That ends the interview with Dennis Walsh on 12th and 13th August, 76.